Okay, so for today's selection, I've choosing to read from Ajahn Tate. It's called Steps Along the Path. And just a little bit of, we haven't done any of his readings yet. He was born in 1902 and died in 1994. And I guess when he died, he was probably one of the most senior of Ajahn Mun's disciples. And I think he was probably one of the most highly respected, too. He was a really well, very, very highly respected monk. And I think this reading is quite fascinating. It was one thing I noticed is, too, is that with the few things I read of Ajahn Tate, it's a, you know, he was much older than some of the others, like we've been reading Ajahn Chah, and so it's like the style's different. It's like it's more written notes that people have taken. And this was a letter, or a Westerner was staying at his monastery and asked him some questions right before he left. And then, unknown to Ajahn Tate, that person took his notes and made a booklet out of it. And then he got a hold of the booklet and then edited it. And then, and so this is the more of a kind of a written. But it's also interesting that he talks kind of very, you know, similar theories or themes that we've been discussing. But in here, he actually goes into quite detail of actually, we talk a lot about, we're hearing a lot about, like, you know, not so much studying from books. And he goes into a lot more detail and actually explains, like, how those insights arise. So I think it's quite amazing. So I'm going to kind of start near the middle, or kind of the very beginning part. He kind of talks about the importance of you know, focusing on the mind, and then he talks a little bit about sila, and then talks about the importance of concentration. And so I'm going to, there's 11 points that he goes through. I'm going to start on point four. So point four: in training the mind, which is a mental phenomena, material objects such as chains and leashes are of no use. The mind has to be trained by tutoring it, first by listening to the explanations of those who are already skilled, and then by being determined to practice in line with those explanations, basing your initial efforts on a sense of trust and convictions if your own independent explorations into cause and effect don't succeed. By and large, people who start out by exploring cause and effect on their own don't reach their desired goals because they lack the proper approach. They miss the true path, tending instead to be biased in favor of their own ideas. To develop first a sense of trust and faith in the individual giving the training and in practicing in line with one is being trained until the mind is firm and unwavering, and then to begin exploring and figuring things out in line with the way they really are. This is what will give rise to satisfactory results. This is because to begin by exploring cause and effect is usually a manner of looking at things from the outside, following external influences. This person says that, that person says this. But to investigate and explore cause and effect exclusively within the bounds of the body, i.e., what is this body of mind made of? How does it come about so that its parts are complete and able to perform their duties well? What is it to be used for? What keeps it going? Is it really mine? And then going on to mental phenomena. Do greed, anger, delusion, love, hatred, and so forth arise at the body or at the mind? What do they come from? When they arise, are they pleasant or stressful? To reason and explore things strictly internally in this way is in and of itself training the mind. But if your stillness of mind isn't yet strong enough, don't go reasoning in line with books you may have read or the things you may have heard other people say, because even though you may think things through, it won't lead you to the truth. In other words, it won't lead you to a sense of dispassion and detachment. So instead, explore and investigate things in line with cause and effect that actually arise from the mind in the present. Point number five: the mind, which is investigating and figuring things out in line with its own personal reasonings in this way, will tend to focus exclusively on examining a single spot on a single object. This is called one-pointed concentration. This is a gathering of the mind's energies so that they have great strength. able to uproot attachments, mistaken presuppositions, and to cleanse the mind so that it is, for the moment, bright and clear. At the very least, you will experience peace, an extreme sense of well-being in body and mind, and perhaps knowledge of one sort or another. Knowledge of a strange and striking sort, since it arises not from mental imagings, but from the cause and effect of the truth acting in the present, in a way that has never happened before. Even if it is knowledge of something you may have suspected all along, only now is it your own, making your mind bright, driving away all doubts and uncertainty about matters that may have been occupying your thoughts. You will say to yourself, with a sense of deep satisfaction and relief, "So, that's how it is." Those whose sensitivities are dull, though, won't be convinced and delighted in their knowledge until someone else confirms it, or if they see the teachings of the Buddha in books bearing witness to what they have learned. This is in line with the fact that the Buddha's followers are of various sorts. This type of knowledge, no matter how much or how wide-ranging it is, won't weigh on your nerves. On the contrary, it is a form of calm and true well-being which will greatly brighten and refresh your nerves. At the same time, it will refine your mind and manners in a way that will be inspiring to others. Whatever you say or do, you will do mindfully, with hardly any careless lapses. Once this happens to you, you should try to maintain all these traits and not grow careless or complacent. These are all individual matters and won't occur in every case, but at any rate, when you have trained the mind, as explained above, even if you don't receive results in full measure, you will still experience a striking sense of peace and well-being in proportion to the extent of your own individual practice. You should then try to maintain this mental state. Don't let feelings of greed or desire, disappointment or dejection arise. Keep the mind neutral and continue practicing as I have explained from the beginning, with a sense of trust and conviction. Be mindful, careful, and observant at every stage of your practice, and you will then meet with the results you hoped for. Point number 6. If training the mind in line with points 4 and 5 don't produce results, then gather your awareness and focus it firmly on a single object or mental image as the target. For example, focus on an aspect of the body, the bones or one of its internal organs, so as to see its objectionable nature. Or you may focus simply on the mind, on bare awareness itself. For the mind is something which can't be seen with the physical eye. If it isn't focused on a single point, you won't know whether or not it's present. The mind is like the wind. If the wind doesn't come into contact with anything, you won't know whether or not it's there. So it is with the mind. If a new trainee doesn't have a target for the mind, he or she won't really be able to catch hold of the mind. But please don't choose anything outside of the body as your target. Make your target the object of the mind, an aspect of the body as already mentioned. And when you take aim, focus on a single object which seems right for you. Don't be greedy, first taking some of this and then a little of that. In focusing, examine the object in line with the principles of the foundations of mindfulness, Satipatthana. In other words, sort out the body's various aspects until you can see, this isn't me, this isn't myself. The sort of focused explanations which give rise to this realization, you can do in two ways. The first way, when focused exclusively on the target, don't give any thought to what the target is or who is focusing. Let there simply be awareness of the act of focusing. Don't let there be any naming or labeling of anything at all. There will simply be the single sensation which makes you feel that you are sticking with the target, but don't think about what the target is. Method 2. When focused exclusively on the target, at the same time keep yourself aware that this is the target of the mind. This is the mind examining. This is mindfulness, the act of remembering to keep the target in mind. This is discernment, which sees into the truth of the objects under consideration. Both methods work, although method A is suited for beginners and those whose sensitivities are not yet developed, while method B is suited for those who are sensitive and experienced. Both methods, though, if you practice them diligently, give rise to the same results, namely concentration and discernment. Point 7. In training the mind, as explained above, no matter which method you choose, please don't let yourself wonder about whether or not you're going to attain concentration and discernment, and put aside all desires based on the various rumors and reports that get passed around by word of mouth. Just follow correctly the method mentioned in point 6, and you'll be doing fine. At the same time, observe the approach you've been practicing to see how you brought the mind to the object, how you maintain mindfulness, and what happened to the mind as a result. If acting in that particular manner made the mind open and bright, keep at it until you're adept and able to do it all the time. But if the results weren't like that, i.e. just the opposite, then without delay, use your powers of observation in the way already mentioned to make adjustments and corrections. In observing how the mind behaves under training, some people will be able to observe their states of mind while the mind is still in that state. Others, only after the mind has withdrawn from that state and stopped still for a moment. Both ways work. They are simply a matter of individual temperament. But if you don't use your powers of observation at all, progress in mental training will be hard to achieve, and even if you do achieve it, hard to maintain. Okay, point 8. Ajahn Karunadhamma brought this up in his last Dhamma talk, and I was talking to a guest. I think this is kind of interesting. While you are training the mind, one thing, strange and striking, may occur without your intending it. That is, the mind will withdraw from its external objects and gather into a single whole, letting go of all labels and attachments, dealing with past and future. There will be just bare awareness paired with its preoccupation in the present. This is something with no sense of inside or outside, a condition whose features are peculiar to the mind itself. It is as if everything has undergone a revolution. This is the mind coming to its own level, the bhavanga. In this moment, everything has reference only to the mind. Even though life may still be going on, the mind, when it reaches this level, lets go of all attachments to the body and goes inward to experience nothing but its own object, all by itself. This is termed bhava-citta, the mind on its own level. The mind on its own level still has refined versions of the five khandhas complete within it, and so can still experience birth and states of becoming, and give rise to continued births in the future. Reaching this state is somewhat like dozing off and dreaming. The difference depends on how much self-awareness there is. Those who are collected and perceptive will, when the event first occurs, be aware of what is happening and what they are experiencing, and so won't get excited or upset. Those who are gullible, are not very mindful though, will be just like a person who dozes off and dreams. When they come to, they will tend to be startled or get misled by the visions they may have seen. But when they have trained themselves until they are skilled at giving rise to this state often, their sense of mindfulness will improve and their visions will go away. Gradually, they will gain insight until they see into the natural conditions as they actually are. Point 9. The phenomenon discussed in point 8, even though it doesn't give rise to discernment capable of exploring into the logic of cause and effect in a wide-ranging way, is still a preliminary stage in training the mind. It can suppress the five hindrances and at the same time give rise to a sense of peace and well-being in the present. If it is properly developed so that it doesn't deteriorate, it will lead to a good rebirth in the future stage, in line with one's karmic background. Incidentally, when visions and signs of various sorts appear, it's usually in this type of mental moment that we are discussing. But this doesn't mean that when the mind reaches this stage, there will have to be visions or signs in every case. With some people, and at some times, they will occur. With others, and at other times, they won't. This is another matter of individual temperament and of other factors as well. To be perfectly truthful, when it comes to the question of visions and signs that arise in the course of meditation, you can say that they're good only in the case of meditators who are quick-witted and astute enough to see through them, who, when they see visions, don't fall for them or latch on to them as being the self or as really belonging to themselves. They see the visions simply as visions, enough to see them as tools or a temporary dwelling place for the mind, and then let go. As for people who aren't especially mindful or alert, who are gullible to boot, when a vision arises, they will get extremely excited and may even become so deluded as to lose touch with reality because they believe the visions to be something real and true. How to deal with visions and signs will be discussed in point 11 below. In addition, people who have trained their minds to this stage are usually stubborn and bullheaded in their opinions due to the strength of their mind. When they think about something, they tend to see it from only one side. They won't easily give any heed to the opinions of others because they believe that their own opinions are perfectly reasonable and trustworthy, even though their opinions are self-serving and very much lacking in reason, and so they easily pervert the way they see things. But at any rate, whether or not visions and signs arise, they're not really what you want here, because aside from being defilements, clouding your discernment, they are also obstacles to the development of clear insight. The aim of training the mind is to let go of the five hindrances and then to examine the khandhas so that they can be seen clear, to see them as they actually are, to the point where you grow disenchanted with them, lose your passion and fascination with them, and let them go, never to enter into and take hold of them again. Point number 10. When you have trained the mind to be firmly established in absorption and concentration to the point where it is able to suppress the five hindrances, then you should work at developing clear insight. Actually, clear insight may arise at the same time that you are working on tranquility. In other words, discernment may brighten so as to know and see clearly the truth that all conditioned things, sankhara, which arise, are bound to disintegrate and pass away. They can't last. They aren't me or myself, but are simply natural conditions acting on their own. When this sort of knowledge arises, it will make the mind become disenchanted and dispassionate with regards to all conditioned things. The mind will dwell entirely in a state of matured and chastened dispassion. No matter what it sees or hears, and no matter where, this is called clear insight occurring together with tranquility. If, however, insight doesn't arise in this way, then, when you have practiced tranquility meditation until the mind is firmly established, then you can select either a part of the body, such as the bones or the intestines, or else a topic which is occupying your thoughts at the present moment, and examine it so as to see that all things which the mind fastens onto as stable and real, as leading to true happiness, actually fall under this way of the three characteristics, the way we assume things, saying, this is this and that is that, in line with our own imaginings, is not in any way true. All conditioned things simply arise from their own causes, unawareness, craving, attachment, and kama. When their causes are exhausted, they disband of their own accord. No one forces them to disband. Even the body we are living in is able to survive only in dependence on causes, such as the breath and food. When these things are exhausted, the body has no meaning at all. When you examine things in this way, using the power of a fully concentrated mind, you will reach the goal of the mind's training. The light of discernment will arise, complete with the insights into cause and effect you have discovered totally on your own. This is something which arises not from appropriating labels or theories memorized from other people, but from realizing the cause and effect that are entirely within your own heart. The mind will never again be deluded into becoming attached, passionate, pleased, or displeased with any conditioned thing at all. Incidentally, we can say that if the mind hasn't truly and clearly seen into the object of its meditation, then it hasn't really yet gathered itself together and settled down. But the reason why the training of the mind isn't called insight meditation before this point is because one's discernment is still weak in terms of cause and effect and lacks circumspection. Okay, point 11. The visions and signs that arise from the practice of meditation are a strange and uncanny affair. They may delude a gullible person of weak judgment into being so convinced of their truth as to lose touch with reality. For this reason, those who practice meditation should be cautious, examining and reflecting on them carefully, as I will now explain. The signs that arise from meditation are of two sorts, visions and signs. A. Visions. Sometimes, when the mind gathers itself into its own level, while we are considering our own body to see its unattractiveness, we will see the body as completely foul and decomposing, or as nothing more than a skeleton or a pile of ashes, etc. There are cases where this has caused people to become so repelled that they commit suicide. In other cases, visions of divine beings or of hell beings or hungry ghosts may sometimes appear. B. As for signs, when the mind gathers, as already mentioned, a whispering voice may appear. It may be the voice of a person we respect, telling us to examine a particular truth, or to be aware of a coming event, or else it may be the voice of an enemy who means to do us harm, appearing to us just before he or she will come to do us harm, which shows how the mental currents of different individuals interpinge on one another. On the other hand, the same sort of thing may occur involving a person who means us well. Sometimes an unidentified voice may come to tell us a truth which is thought-provoking and worthy of consideration, which meditators in general call the teachings and warnings of the Dhamma, or Abhinya. It's not the case that visions and signs will occur to all meditators. With some people, no matter how refined a level their minds attain, visions and signs won't appear. With others, the mind may gather in a flash for a brief moment, and all sorts of visions and signs will appear. This depends on the individual's temperament. With people who are gullible and don't give much thought to what is reasonable, visions and signs tend to occur quickly and to grow out of bounds to the point where they can lose their bearings, so treat them with caution. Question: Are visions and signs true? Answer: Sometimes yes, and sometimes no. Because they arise exclusively from jhana, and jhana is a mundane phenomenon, thus undependable. That is to say, they arise to a person practicing meditation whose mind gathers into bhavanga without knowing what level it has reached or how it focused on, examined, and put down its object. Visions and signs, whether or not they arise intentionally, are composed of a great deal of mental concocting and attachment, and are therefore unreliable, because the visions and signs that arise when the mind is in the bhavanga are like the dreams of a person who lies down to sleep or simply dozes off. By and large, when they first occur, there tends to be some truth to them, but not much. Question: Is jhana mundane or transcendent? Answer: Jhana has only 12 or 13 component factors, and they are entirely mundane. But if the person entering jhana is a noble one, using it as a tool or a dwelling place of the mind, then he or she will be able to use this mundane jhana at will, and dependably as well, like an expert sharpshooter, as opposed to a person just learning how to shoot, or like a king whose sword is part of his regalia, as opposed to a commoner whose sword is just a sword. Question: Are visions and signs a good thing? Answer: Only for a person who knows how to make use of them in the proper way without being taken in by them and attached to them. They aren't good for a person who doesn't know how to use them properly, who gets taken in by them, believing them to be true. Once attachment latches on, the act of mental concocting can make these visions and signs proliferate to the point where the meditator may lose control over his or her sense of reality. So they should be treated with caution and care, as I will now explain. Visions and signs arise from the power of mundane jhana and are sustained by attachment and mental concocting. They thus fall under the three characteristics. They are inconstant, they can't last, they are stressful, and they are not self. They aren't yours or anyone else's. They are conditions which do nothing but constantly arise and fall away in their own way at all times. Examine them so as to see their true nature in this way, and then let them go. Don't be deluded into latching on to visions and signs, which are the results. Instead, work at the cause, jhana, so that you become more and more adept at the point where you can attain it at will. The visions and signs will take care of themselves. Also learn to see the drawbacks of visions and signs. Once they arise and we get engrossed and deluded into latching onto them, they will cause your jhana to deteriorate. Just as sound waves are an obstruction to a person trying to quiet the mind and explore phenomena which are suitable and deep, or the waves of clear water prevent us from seeing our reflection on the water's surface. The visions and signs which appear to a meditator just beginning to attain jhana tend to be extraordinary and amazing. The acts of mental grasping and concocting will tend to fasten tightly to them, and they will be indelibly impressed on the inner eye. If the above methods for curing and removing these visions and signs don't produce results, then try not to have the mind enter into jhana. In other words, don't put your mind to it. Don't let the mind be still. Don't take a liking to the visions and signs. Sleep and eat as much as you like. Perform heavy tasks until the body is very tired. Think of objects that will give rise to defilements, such as beautiful sights or sounds that will give rise to desire. And once the mind withdraws from its absorption, the visions and signs will disappear of their own accord. I can attest to that. That's true. That's true. If the student meditator can't solve the problem with these methods, then the teacher should try to help by using the same sort of approach. The quickest and most effective way is to find an issue that will provoke the person attached to visions and signs to extreme anger. The visions and signs will immediately disappear. The basis for giving rise to knowledge into the Dhamma is threshold concentration. Upachara Samadhi, which is of two sorts. A. As a meditator is working with a particular object of meditation, the mind will gradually withdraw from its external preoccupation and gather into one spot, right at the mind itself, but without being able to completely cut off from all objects. It is still sensing, thinking, and considering, trying to withdraw from its very refined object, but as yet unable to let go completely. This is threshold concentration before reaching fixed penetration, Apana Samadhi. B. The mind becomes more and more refined until it is able to let go and withdraw from the object it is considering, so that the object disappears. This is called fixed penetration. There is full mindfulness and awareness of a sense of emptiness, not grasping after or fastening onto anything at all, simply partaking of its own exclusive object. When the mind comes out of this state and is again considering the Dhamma, objects, cause and effect, this is threshold concentration coming out of fixed penetration. Both sorts of threshold concentration can form a good basis for insight into particular truths in various events, which is different from the knowledge which arises from the signs and visions mentioned above. Because visions and signs arising from mundane jhana, whereas the knowledge we're discussing here, even though it arises from mundane concentration, gives more dependable results. And if your concentration becomes transcendent, it will do away step by step with all the affluence, asavas, of the mind. In short, the knowledge which arises from visions and signs and that which arises from threshold concentration differ in terms of both origin and of quality. An item which deserves a little more explanation here is the term fixed penetration, Apana Samadhi. Fixed penetration is a superior human attainment. By and large, people who have reached fixed penetration tend to focus on the in and out breath, anapana, as their object of meditation. As they focus on the breath and come to pay attention to its arising and falling away, or just to its falling away, the mind gradually becomes more and more refined until, step by step, it lets go of all its preoccupations and gathers together to become fixed, as explained below. The stilling of the in-and-out breath is what indicates fixed penetration. In some instances, it is called fixed jhana because it comes from the act of becoming absorbed in the breath. It is called fixed concentration because even though there is no in-out breath, when the mind reaches that point, mindfulness is still absolutely full. When you are in this state, you can't examine anything because the mind is totally uninvolved with anything at all. Only when the mind comes out of this state and enters threshold concentration can you begin examining things again. You will then see clearly into all the truths that the Buddha said are to be known, and into other matters as well. There will be no visions and signs, as mentioned above, but the knowledge here will be based on cause and effect, complete with analogies and similes that will utterly ease all doubt. In some cases, meditators will consider objects of meditation other than in and out breath, and yet will still be able to reach fixed penetration in the same way that those who practice mindfulness of breathing. When the mind gathers to a point where there is no more in-out breathing, that's fixed penetration. This, at any rate, is my opinion on the matter. Meditators shouldn't take my opinion as their criterion, because the thoughts and opinions of people in this world, even when we see the same thing under the same conditions in the same place, can formulate different names for and reach different understanding about those same things, and thus give rise to endless disputes and arguments. Simply let us all work with our own objects of meditation so as to reach fixed penetration as discussed above, and then, with a fair mind free from bias, compare what we experience with what have been formulated in the various texts. Our knowledge will then be pachatang, arising exclusively within ourselves. That is what I would like to see in this regard.